Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens. So are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passaran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Dr. Helen Young, who is the author of Global Medievalism. Thanks for joining us, Helen.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I guess just to begin with, could you tell us a little bit about where your interest in medievalism and matters medieval stems from?
Oh, look, that's a bit of a long story. The earliest I can date it back to is my dad reading me The Hobbit when I was about 4 or 5. And I had a lot of medieval Lego when I was a kid. I've still got that, although I've collected a bit more recently. And then I just grew up reading a lot of fantasy, which in the 90s had a lot of medieval settings, a bit more diversity in that now. And then I did a PhD in 14th century English literature. And that sort of solidified a bit of a career trajectory, except there were no jobs in medieval literature in Australia in 2007. So I sort of reinvented myself a bit. Now I've worked on fantasy literature, and medievalism is, I guess, the word for the reception of the Middle Ages. So things we do with the idea of the Middle Ages and stuff to do with them in the modern period.
Yeah, so taking a slightly more critical view of things than the Legos.
Yeah, probably, although I have written about Lego video games.
Oh. Well, maybe we'll get to the Lego video games. Could we start with, in terms of the far right, how does the medieval fit into sort of, I guess, the fascist imaginary?
Well, you know, fascists love the Middle Ages, and they have since there were fascists. So one of the reasons for that, and this goes to where it fits in their imaginary, is that there's a general view just in the mainstream that the Middle Ages happened in Europe, and therefore to white people, that they're part of just the general heritage of the West. And this is probably even more important to fascists, that they were a time of really significant social hierarchy. So, you know, think feudalism, think there was an upper class, it's a belief there was no middle class, and then there were peasants who had to do what the upper class told them, or they got brutally killed, and perhaps that happened anyway. And also there's, you know, if you think about something like, say, Game of Thrones, there's a real belief that the Middle Ages were a very violent period. And so there's a whole lot of different resonances with a sort of fascist politics in mainstream beliefs about the Middle Ages. And so they work, that idea of the Middle Ages works for them in some quite general, widespread ways.
Helen, I understand that The Lord of the Rings plays a particular role, or has played a particular role, in the culture surrounding Italian fascism. Are there other contemporary texts that have found their place as propaganda among right-wing groups?
Yes. Probably Lord of the Rings is one of the more well-known and significant ones, and it has been a real conduit for mainstreaming of general far-right talking points, certainly in the last 10 or 15 years. Look, I mean, the far-right are very adept at using popular culture generally, so there's a few other medievalist texts specifically that they have used quite a lot. So the History Channel had that show Vikings. They're really into that and pick up on different pop culture texts that use Vikings quite a lot. And they're very active, say, in Look, in some ways, that's a hard question because they can use almost anything. They're really good at interpreting narrative and turning it to suit their own talking points.
I guess the other way in which, apart from these tales of adventure and derring do and so on and so forth, how does the concept of, and I think you've referred to this in terms of how the medieval period is generally understood, but how does whiteness inform these interpretations of that period in history?
Well, one of the kind of general beliefs about the Middle Ages was, like I said, that Europe was pretty much just full of white people and nobody else. So they think about the European Middle Ages as being the last time, or as being a time when, I guess, what they would usually call Aryan culture flourished in a pure form. So for different elements of the far right have different views on that. So for some of them who think that Christianity is, you know, a Semitic religion, part of a Jewish plot to wipe out the white race, they're into the Middle Ages in a different way, right? So they're interested more in Vikings rather than knights, for example. But generally it fits into the idea of their ideas of whiteness because they think of it as a time where there was just racially pure whiteness in Europe. It's wildly anachronistic and also not true, but that's the vision that they have. It's this idea that they have. And that comes pretty much mainly out of 19th century beliefs about late 18th and 19th century beliefs about race and about history.
Helen, obviously our understanding of history evolves over time. You write in the book about how our understanding of what the Middle Ages was in 2020 is very different to what it was, you know, even in 1990, and certainly different to what it was in, you know, 1890. How is our understanding of the Middle Ages changing?
Honestly, it depends on who you mean by our. So academic research has certainly shifted quite a lot. I mean, over time, but in probably the last 20 to 30 years, there's been much more of an interest in the ways that Europe was connected to the rest of the world during the 1,000 years or so between 500 and 1500, and increasing recognition that it actually really was almost globally connected, and recognition that Europe, you know, life in Europe, societies in Europe were much more complicated and heterogeneous than we tend to think. That's something that academics have been talking about, drawing attention to for longer than we've been seeing it in popular culture, but we are also now starting to, probably in the last 5 to 10 years, see a little bit more recognition that the Middle Ages wasn't all just, you know, white Christians fighting the Crusades against brown-skinned Arabic Muslim people, right?
And is there much pushback to this evolution in the world of academia? It seems that some people might not be too impressed with the wokening of the Middle Ages.
Yes, there's, you know, academics are as politically diverse as the rest of the world, I would say. You know, there is a popular misconception that everyone in a university is a rabid leftist. It's very much not true. Look, there are certainly a range of different opinions. There are academics who are, I know of a few mainly based in the US, who are quite closely connected to far-right movements there and very hostile to any of the research I've been talking about, and also pushback against academics from far-right actors. You know, I know of some, again in the US, but I wouldn't, and elsewhere in the US and Europe, who have received death threats for doing this work and talking about it publicly.
Alan, you've examined one author in particular, Harold A. Covington, who's produced some fantasy material. What's the connection between his, I guess, role as a neo-Nazi activist and what he produced in his literature?
Well, what he said about his fiction, and he wrote across a whole range of, like, popular genres. So he wrote science fiction, he wrote horror, he wrote probably less so straight fantasy, like he didn't really write Lord of the Rings type stuff, but he wrote medieval crime fiction, he wrote historical fiction, like all the things. What he said about his books was that they all had a political message. And so one of the things I found or was interested in looking at his books and trying to understand the fiction that he was producing, what I was trying to work out was, okay, how does somebody who is a self-avowed neo-Nazi activist, that was what he devoted his life to, how do those politics actually show up in a work of popular fiction? And look, there's a range of ways that they do, depending on the story. But pretty much what happens is that in across all of those genres I mentioned, you get a white male hero figure who saves some other white people through violence. So his most famous quintet was a set of semi-science fiction books set in an imagined near future in which the northwest of the United States broke away as a white ethno-state and successfully fought for independence from the US. So there's a really clear political vision and a political message in that, and that was his political aim. But this figure of like violent white man who saves the day, often revealing political corruption or something like that along the way, and who therefore restores social order and social hierarchy, comes up right throughout everything that he produces.
And who was it that was publishing these books or this material, and how did they, I guess, circulate? Did they prove to be popular?
Look, Covington self-published everything. Okay, so he tried to get publishing deals in the late 20th century and couldn't. I mean, he's, as far as a writer of popular fiction go, he's readable as long as you don't mind his politics, which are really there. So what happened for him and his books was that he discovered self-publishing really early on, and he wrote about this a couple of different times and sort of talked about this. And this is some research I did with a colleague, Jeff Boucher. And basically what he said was, well, I can write whatever I like in fiction because it won't get censored. It won't get me targeted for, you know, by law enforcement in the way it would if I made threats in a nonfiction space. And yeah, so he was an early proponent of self-publishing services where there are companies, you know, long pre-Amazon, where you send off your text and they print it out as a book and then sell it through what was then Barnes & Noble and Waterstones and some of those earlier big chains. And his exploitation of that system has been taken up by, I would say, it's fair to say, sort of hundreds of white supremacist far-right authors right through into digital self-publishing on places like the Amazon Kindle store's been identified as a locus of this, and on a whole range of different file sharing sites as well. Some of them, some books say by, there's a couple of sort of survivalist militia members who have cracked New York Times bestseller lists with books that resonate with those ideas about the collapse of civilization and maybe forming a white ethno-state or something like that, although none of them have been really self-professed neo-Nazis in the way that Covington was.
Helen, you mentioned Lego games before.
I did.
Could you tell us a little bit about your research into video games and perhaps the medieval or perhaps the far right?
Okay. Well, there's a whole lot of overlap there. So my research into video games started out when I had a research fellowship looking at racism in fantasy. And my thought there was, okay, in a fantasy world, you can imagine anything. Anything's possible. So what are people imagining to do with race and racism? And you can't really seriously research fantasy without thinking about what video games are like, because, you know, this was sort of 2010, 2012. Games then, like World of Warcraft, are absolutely huge, and Skyrim. So medieval games were part of that project. And again, pretty soon I ran in, that was sort of the Tolkien project as well. It was all part of the same fantasy project about race and racism. I ran into really just white supremacist sites talking about fantasy, talking about video games, talking about medieval fantasy, talking about medieval video games. So it was all sort of part of the same fascist soup of stuff that they liked. And, you know, at first I found it quite confronting because I love Lord of the Rings and I love some of my medieval video games. And I was like, well, I don't want fascists to like these things that I like. But they do. And it was pretty clear that they do. So it sort of seemed like that was something I wanted to understand a little bit better. And I haven't actually uncovered, haven't encountered any white supremacists in LEGO video gaming, but...
Thank goodness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're there in Roblox, so yeah. Look, the race politics that are coded into Lord of the Rings and that are coded into a lot of other fantasy video games that white supremacists like are absolutely there in the LEGO ones as well. And that actually is one of the things I wrote about, that hierarchies of race that are coded into, you know, humans versus orcs versus elves versus dwarves and so on in a fantasy world are literally a white supremacist fantasy, because in those imagined digital worlds, race actually exists in the way that they want it to exist and work in reality.
Helen, I often see games like Crusader Kings being used by people in the far right space to sort of live out alternative histories. Could you speak a little bit about how alternative histories are employed in video gaming and maybe even more generally in, you know, fiction to advance white supremacist ideas?
Yeah, so absolutely. They use gaming and also sometimes write their own novels that fantasize different historical outcomes, you know, counterfactual events. Partly what that's to do with is just the individuals enjoying that fantasy, right? There's a individual level where you're that engaged in a really active form of racism and consciously, where it's fun. And the fun of playing video games, the entertainment value, is part of why they are useful for the far right, because it makes their perspectives, their narratives, their ideas, associates those with things that people enjoy. It gives them something in common with other people who also like games. And so it's a viable space for community building. And playing an alternate history game or an alternate history in something like Crusader Kings, on one hand, there's the individual enjoyment, but there's also that form of community enjoyment if you're streaming it, if you're playing with other people, where it's, so it's community building, you're enjoying the same things together. But also if you're streaming or, you know, engaging in chat forums or something like that, if you're talking about the games and the way that you're playing them, it gives them opportunities to introduce ideological talking points that suit their political ends, because there's a topic where it's easy to raise that. And also there's, and this is particularly true with some of the novels that I've read that are alternate histories, it gives them a space to actually make false historical claims, to advance false historical claims. So one of the big ones, or one of the common ones, and I've come across this in a couple of different novels by white supremacists, by you know, American neo-Nazi figures, is that during the Middle Ages, Norse people settled in North America. And we know this, there's archaeological evidence of one settlement now in Canada. And people have also seen that on, you know, the Vikings on the History Channel and just come across it. That's something people know about. And so their alternate history is that rather than those settlements failing and those people either dying or going back to Scandinavia or Iceland, their fantasy is that those people survived and built civilizations and built new settlements right through North America and particularly in the United States. And they'll then write into those fictional narratives claims that, that archaeological sites in North America were actually built by white descendants of the Vikings, not by Native American people. Because they say, oh, well, that's they believe that whatever it might be is too complicated for Native American people to have built. So they say, okay, well, it was descendants of Vikings that built the mounds at Cahokia or something like that. And so there's – they destabilize or undermine institutional history and history that people otherwise accept as true.
Could you tell us a bit about the concept of counter storytelling and what can sort of be done to, you know, de-racify these fields?
Okay. So counter storytelling is a concept that actually comes out of critical race studies, which people might remember was very controversial a couple of years ago. And basically what it the premise of counter storytelling is that we have particular big narratives that shape what we believe about culture and society and how the world works. And counter storytelling is basically saying, well, actually, no, it's more complicated than that, and here are some other perspectives. So counter storytelling might consist of so the story might consist of the history about Australia that I was taught in primary school, and I was in primary school during the bicentenary, where some fairly intrepid British convicts and settlers came and settled Australia and made this great nation. And it's a bit unfortunate the Aboriginal people died from diseases a lot, but aren't we terrific now? So counter storytelling might be pretty much anything that disrupts that narrative. So it could happen in, you know, in school curricula, which is, you know, that's not the version of Australian history that my kids are getting in primary school now. It can happen in places like popular fiction. So there's quite a lot of recent historical fiction written from Indigenous perspectives. One just won a big historical fiction prize, a book by Tasma Walton. There's, you know, similar things can happen, say, in a fantasy game that, say, something like the Dragon Age franchise, where you have inclusion of characters of colour, of queer characters, of different kinds of people in different kinds of situations that you might not necessarily get in a game that positions itself as here is an historical game. So counter storytelling is really about saying, recognizing that the world and people are much more diverse and complicated than a fairly simple, often conservative or traditional mainstream story might recognize, and bringing in their perspectives, bringing in their existence, and creating narratives that actually acknowledge something of how interesting and complicated the world actually is in a fantasy world or a medievalist world or whatever it might be.
Well, Helen, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on. If people want to find you online, they can look up Dr. Helen Young, or you are on Blue Sky at heyyouonline.bsky.social. You can
that
admire some of your Lego work. Andy, we'll be back next week.
We will.
See you then.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks for having me.
The annual Melbourne Pacifica Festival is on again, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday, December the 6th, at the playground end of Banjo Paterson Park in Lynbrook. Immerse yourself in the richness of Pacific Island culture with traditional dance, dynamic drumming, soulful harmonies, bands, guest artists, children's activities including rugby clinics, Pacifica arts and crafts, and yummy food. Lots of fun and activities for the whole family. Saturday, December the 6th in Lynbrook. Visit melbournepacificafestival.org. Melbourne Pacifica Festival is a 3CR supporter.
Awkward Giraffe presents the Festival of Critical Comedy 2025 on the weekend of the 29th and 30th of November, 2 p.m. to 8 at the Melbourne Unitarian Peace Church, 110 Grey Street, East Melbourne. Awkward Giraffe promotes comedy to make you think. Lineup includes comedy legends Greg Fleet and Nick Sun, and the groundbreaking Ridiculousness and Doppelgangster and much more. Free entry. For more details, see awkwardgiraffe.net. Awkward Giraffe proudly supports 3CR.